This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joining us is the director of the UW Virology Lab, Dr. Keith Jerome. So tell me about the thinking behind the pause of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine over these six cases, which is statistically tiny, not to diminish the significance of getting a blood clot, of course. But is that standard procedure?
Yeah, well, Dave, you're exactly right. This is a pause, so we don't know how this is going to end up. But, yeah, it is standard. When we have a brand new vaccine of any type, there's a lot of very careful observation for rare side effects. So these vaccines get tested initially in a small group of people, and if they show any problems, they pretty much end at that point. And then the final clinical trial that we do before they go out to the public usually has tens of thousands of folks. So the vaccine trials had typically about 30,000 people in each of them for approval. What that means is that the really rare side effects, the one in a million sorts of things, you can't see in those. And so that's why we very carefully follow up people after they get the vaccine or other therapeutics to try and understand these rare things. And so you're right. This is a very small number of people, but this is a potentially serious complication for the unfortunate folks who get it. So the pause is to try to look at the data, make sure that there's a real linkage here. And then if it is something real, figure out what's the pathway forward. And is it something where the benefits outweigh the risks? Are there groups that we can identify who just shouldn't get this vaccine and so forth? Or it could be that the vaccine will just not be used going forward. But my guess is that it'll be some sort of middle ground.
On the decision to roll back some of the counties to phase two, including Pierce County, of course, there's been a lot of pushback to that. It's very discouraging to get a taste of freedom only to be clapped back in your cell again. But what is the argument for doing that county by county, as opposed to trying to figure out, okay, where is the spreading happening, and then actually targeting those situations?
Yeah, you'd ideally identify the very specific places where transmission is occurring. Of course, there aren't single individual cases that you can identify a priori. So you end up with a little bit of a blunt hammer, which is, I think, what you're seeing here, right? That it has to sort of happen at the county level. Obviously, that is substantially more fine-grained than a statewide rollback.
So it is, you're saying it's just not possible to collect the kind of data that can point to, let's say, a particular restaurant or a particular public event that was responsible for the spread?
Well, that certainly can be done, and there are cases of that. The problem is that doesn't necessarily give you something to do going forward, right? If you identify that this particular restaurant had a transmission case, but you find out that they were actually doing everything right, they were following the cleaning and they were keeping people separated and they had the windows open and all the things you're supposed to do, then you know, what's the recommendation that actually makes things any better than they were? So it's a tough place. I think nobody really, the last thing anybody wants to do is roll back into more strict limits. And I think even, statewide leaders don't want to do that because it's unpopular. So when they do it, I think the sense is that it's important and unfortunate, but necessary.
Now, I know you've been tracking the evolution of this virus since we first started talking. Have we learned anything more about which direction is it going? Is it evolving into being more infectious and deadly or less infectious and deadly?
It's definitely evolving toward being more infectious. There's no doubt about that. We now, Dave, sequence, and that's how you figure out what the variants are. We actually sequence everything that comes through our lab now. So it's very clear that the majority of the cases we see now are these variants that are more infectious. We're seeing a lot of the so-called UK variant, this B117 variant, as well as the variants that were originally identified in California that are thought to be more infectious. So that's definitely true. They may be a bit more severe, and I think there's particularly for the so-called UK variant, there's some pretty good evidence that their disease may be more severe. That's being modified some now that our highest risk groups have had a lot of vaccinations. So we are seeing an uptick in cases, but the number of hospitalizations and particularly deaths is remaining low. So there's some optimism that that'll continue going forward.
So are we seeing the impact of the vaccine already?
I think so. Just in terms of, again, we made a conscious decision to protect our citizens who were at the highest risk of severe disease and death. And that's particularly the oldest folks among us. So I think that's proven to be a pretty good decision, and that's paying off in many fewer deaths. Doesn't mean that younger people can't have severe disease. Some end up in the hospital, and some unfortunately have died. If we look at sort of the population level numbers, though, they are better in that regard.
The rampant spread going on overseas now in Europe, in Brazil, and especially I hear in India, does that end up affecting us? Insofar as, my understanding is, that's how the virus evolves more quickly when you have a spread like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, our first order of business is getting our own ship in order. And we've talked a lot about where the United States hasn't done a good job. But in the vaccination rollout, we've actually done a really good job. And we're really one of the best countries in the world in terms of doing that. And when I speak with my colleagues, my professional colleagues from other countries, they're really very impressed with what we've done in the U.S. And they're actually personally a little jealous that many of them have not been able to get their vaccine yet, compared to many folks now here in the United States. So that's all good. We need to do that first. But then I think we do need to look overseas and start to think about how we can actually help or encourage or provide advice, because that could come back to bite us. That is, as you said, where the virus evolves. Every time it infects a new person, it has a chance to evolve into something that's potentially more dangerous. And so the faster we can get those other countries sort of up to snuff as well, the less chance that something will come back around that, for example, our vaccines are less effective at preventing.
Yeah. And so here in Washington State, April 15th, instead of being tax day, because that's been moved, is now Vaccine for Everybody Day. And does that mean the all clear once we've all got it?
Well, certainly so-called Vax Day doesn't mean that we're all clear, because obviously everybody hasn't gotten the vaccine. I mean, one thing we're going to have to deal with in this country, and it'll be interesting to see, is how many people ultimately choose to not get the vaccine or just sort of keep putting it off because of they're scared or because they've heard about this rare side effect with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So if that number's too high, it'll mean that we'll continue to have some cases around the U.S. So I don't think we're out of the woods. We're certainly not out of the woods yet. As I've said for a long time, I still keep looking at summertime as a time when life kind of gets back to something that looks much, much more normal. And I'm still optimistic that that's going to be the case.
Me too. Dr. Jerome, thank you very much. Good to talk to you again.
All right. Take care, Dave.
Let's go.
It's time for Choke Points. I-5 drivers got a good look at the state of repairs on the freeway in Seattle yesterday. Emergency expansion joint work shut down two southbound lanes of the freeway near the West Seattle Bridge for several hours. Welcome back to normal, people. It turns out that this spot is actually up next for significant repairs.
Yep, and that's all part of Revive I-5 right now. The construction's set to begin in May on southbound I-5 from the I-90 interchange to Spokane Street, right where that expansion joint failed yesterday. Five expansion joints are going to be replaced this time on I-5. One will be replaced on westbound I-90 over I-5, and more than a mile of concrete is going to be repaired.
When we built this freeway back in the 60s, it was actually designed, they figured it would last about 25 years before it needed major work.
The Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says the state got more than double that because of some really good concrete installed originally. But the freeway needs a ton of work right now.
We've got about two dozen projects over the next 10 years that's going to be repaving, expansion joints, making sure that the freeway will be safe in an earthquake. We've got a lot of projects like that coming up.
You might not realize it, but most of I-5 just outside of downtown Seattle is actually a bridge. You can see that on a trip down Airport Way. That complicates the repairs a bit and adds time to the project. The plan is to shave down the bad concrete on top and replace it with a polyester concrete. That should prevent the deep grooves from forming. Those are the deep grooves that fill with water and catch your tires and throw you all over the place. Pierce says the work won't be done, though, until the fall of 2022.
We need 16 weekends to do this work, which is why we need to spread it out over a couple of years. We simply can't cram 16 weekends into a single year. That would just be way too inconvenient for people.
Pierce says southbound 5 will be reduced to two lanes during those weekend closures. There could also be a full closure in the mix as well. We'll be watching the schedule very closely to make sure we keep a track of those weekends and warn you when they're going to be in the mix. But it should start sometime next month.
I have to say I'm a fan of the not doing 16 weekends in 1 year. That's a lot.
Exactly. Especially on the, you know, the biggest freeway and the most used freeway in the state. So, yeah, definitely.
No, too much normal for me.
Time now for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. For many of us, finding an available COVID vaccine can seem to require a superhuman effort. In one Pennsylvania community, a pharmacist known as Dr. Mack is using his superpower to save lives.
Dr. Mack is responsible for these shots. This is the Superman who's responsible.
He's known as Dr. Mack, and his Superman costume is a Halloween leftover. But for the people at this pop-up vaccine clinic, Mayank Amin is the real deal.
We'll be back, so let your neighbors know.
Awesome. We appreciate you bringing it to us.
The pharmacist is vaccinating everyone he can in this community 45 minutes outside of Philadelphia, reaching more than 3,500 people in a day.
COVID-19 vaccines have been so tough to get, and when that UPS driver walked through that door and said, here are your vaccines, we were almost dancing, like getting ready to party, because this is what our town has been waiting for.
And now you're delivering your vaccines as Superman.
I continue to wear the Superman costume because of the responses that I've seen from the community. It doesn't require a child to see Superman to get some happiness or joy.
The center of his operation, this small independent pharmacy, until recently the only one in the town of Skipack offering vaccines.
Once the vaccines come into our pharmacy and get put into the freezer, then it's time to move into action.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Tanya Hall says she likely would have had to wait until May to get a vaccine because of her limited mobility.
I live right up the street, you know. It's really great to have something like this close to home.
From large clinics vaccinating hundreds by the hour to visits at home, one at a time.
That's it. You are fully vaccinated.
Yay!
The effort is paying off. The county now has one of the highest per capita vaccination rates in the state, a mission to help others in line with his faith.
My guru, and that's a symbol of my faith. His motto is, in the joy of others lies our own. So anything that we do, if you're bringing somebody else joy, just do it.
How do you think the community will remember this?
I think our community absolutely loves the fact that their local superheroes banded together to do something that no one ever thought was possible.
For CBS This Morning, Nancy Chin, Skipack, Pennsylvania.
And I want to mention, I don't know if we have anybody running around in a superhero costume delivering vaccines, but I do know from our news partners at Cairo 7 TV, their reporter, Dee Dee Sun, she did a story about COVIDWA.com. It's COVIDWA.com, created by locals here that scrape nearly 1,000 sites for available appointments and can give you a text alert when one opens within 20 miles of you. Just looking at the website now, I'm seeing availability around the state. So it might be a good tool for you. As we all search for that elusive shot.
Absolutely. And a reminder to all the parents whose 16-year-olds are now eligible for the vaccine. The only vaccine that the 16-year-olds can get is the Pfizer vaccine. That's the only one. So something to keep in mind as you shop around. From the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, right here on Cairo Radio, we've got G. Scott. G.
Good morning, Hannah. Hannah, wait a minute. Are you in studio?
I am, for the first time in over a year.
The hardest working woman in the state of Washington. Well, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What are we talking about today, Hannah?
We are going to talk about, as you know, the state Supreme Court has essentially legalized drug possession for simple possession. There's no current law in the books for anybody caught with their own personal use amounts of drugs, essentially. And that was because the law that we had on the books didn't require prosecutors to prove that a person knowingly had that. But when this decision came in February, it really took everyone in the criminal justice arena, lawmakers, everybody by surprise. So there's a scramble right now to get it fixed in the 11 days left of the legislative session.
50 years ago, when the war on drugs was introduced by then President Nixon, what was the goal? I'm quite sure that everybody, the goal at that time was to stop people from doing drugs. Because I'll agree, I'm not a drug user. I have seen what drugs have done to people in my family. I've seen what it has done to my friends. So I would assume that that was the goal 50-something years ago.
Agreed.
Question. Did that work?
No.
No. We could all say it did not work. Let's just talk about here at home. The war on homelessness right here in Seattle. How's that going, everybody? It's not working. So what I'm saying is this. Out there in Baltimore, an example of what's happened out there, the state's attorney general, Marilyn J. Mosby, she made an example during the pandemic. She says, you know what? I'm going to try to decriminalize drug possession, and I'm just basically going to see what happens. They had pushback out there. What was the results? In 12 months, since she ordered that scale back of enforcement of that, violent crime is now down 20%. Property crime has declined 36%. I'm bringing this up because here's why. I totally understand anybody saying, are you crazy? No, this drugs are bad. I agree with you. I believe that drugs are bad too. But I also know that what we have been doing for the last 50 years has not been working. And at some point, we're going to have to do something different. And especially, Hannah, you know what they didn't take into account in those 50 years? That in that one approach, the war on drugs was intended to stop drug activity. But as we know, drug use, and we know how drugs in inner cities in the 80s were used to help fund illegal activities in South America. I don't know about you, but ain't no brothers in Compton got a private plane to go get drugs?
No.
Down in Colombia? You know what I mean?
I've been to Compton. No.
No. So I guess what I'm saying is long story short is this. When I first heard, me personally, like drugs and decriminalization and drug possession, I ain't gonna lie, I didn't like it. Why? Because I have personally seen with my own eyes what drugs have done to families, the destruction that is done with my own family. However, if the goal is for better, then sometimes the way we go about things, we might have to change our approach. And if the goal is to have less crime and the goal is to have less drug activity, well, I'm all for trying to do something different. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think that's the discussion that you're hearing in Olympia right now. And the goal is absolutely to have less crimes, to have less drug use, and to save lives. What's different now from the 80s is the opioid crisis and how that has added to the drug and addiction issue that we've seen at crisis levels here in the state, across the country. And there's so much of it. Just takes a hold of a person to such a degree that it's so hard to get off of it. And if you're stigmatizing it, and if you're going in and out of the criminal justice system and coming out of the jail every, 24 hours after you're arrested, there's not any help. So that's the discussion. There's going to be this big, big push for treatment coming out of Olympia for sure. And we'll see what happens. But I think that you will see us move to a decriminalization of small personal amounts of drugs that could make a difference, because everybody agrees that what we have been doing isn't working.
Right. And the opioid crisis that we have going on today, sure. Absolutely, we have that. But we had a crack epidemic going on back then, too. And instead of help, instead of understanding what would happen, go back to history. You lock them up for the crack use and the crack epidemic during that time. And we have to start looking at it different. I mean, one of the things back in the day when I would get, when I get pulled over, one of the questions I get asked, you got any drugs or guns in the car? No, I don't. I don't do drugs. You know what I mean? I don't mess with drugs. But the understanding when it comes to drugs, we have to do a lot better. And in the past, we have failed. And I believe because of our understanding and the way our approach happened, we failed with making a dent into the drug game. And also, it's the same thing with the homelessness crisis. It's the same. You can't just throw money at it. Nope. You actually have to work.
Yep, absolutely. And we'll have more discussions about that again, Scott, because I know there's a lot of effort going on in Olympia for both of the things you just addressed as well, on criminal justice reform and homelessness. Thanks so much for joining us. Hannah Scott in for Dave Ross this morning. Nearly 2 months ago, our state Supreme Court tossed out the state's law that makes simple drug possession a felony. It shocked the criminal justice system in our state and has left prosecutors scrambling to vacate sentences. Joining us live now to help break it all down and talk about what comes next is Snohomish County Prosecutor Adam Cornell. Good morning.
Morning, Hannah.
So first, very briefly, can you explain what this court decision left the state with in regard to people caught with drugs on them, including explaining what simple possession is?
Sure. So the Supreme Court case is called the Blake case. And it was absolutely a monumental decision. What it did was it made the possession of simple possession of controlled substances, hard drugs, all that illegal. And it also has led to the vacation of thousands of convictions going back possibly 40 years. So as a county prosecutor, when the decision came down, my team and I scrambled to dismiss pending cases, make sure that anybody that was in custody on a simple possession charge were released, and we continue to dismiss cases and try to make sure that we're compliant with the Supreme Court's decision in the case. It's a significant effect on the criminal justice system, as you can imagine.
Absolutely. And I know you and I discussed the day that this decision had come down, some of the impact, and it also included drug court and kind of some of the ability for the criminal justice system to assist people, help them get into treatment, correct?
That's true. In Snohomish County, we had approximately 6 to 8 people in our drug court who were in drug court on just a simple possession charge. There are approximately 80 people in drug court, so it wasn't a significant hit, but those were people who were engaged in treatment and services who had to be terminated because we couldn't keep them under an illegal charge.
And right now there's no way for prosecutors to assist anyone dealing with a small simple possession charge in getting into treatment, correct?
There isn't. The Blake decision left a huge vacuum in that area, and so what we are guiding people toward to the extent that we can is treatment and services that are out in the community. But as you well know, there aren't sufficient resources to address this public health threat that is substance use disorder. And so, the Supreme Court made a legal decision. The last time I checked, they didn't get to print money. And so the decision didn't come with any dollars to address the void of treatment. And that's really what we need. And so I'm really hoping that the legislature is going to come through and in help to fund both the provision of having to resentence all these people and handle the extra work as a consequence of Blake. But I'm also hopeful that the state is going to step up and make sure that we're providing money to address people's behavioral health issues and other attendant issues, because that's really what we need to be doing, Hannah.
Yes, absolutely. I want to touch quickly on something you talked about, because I've heard it from other prosecutors, the astronomical undertaking that it is to go back and look at the resentencing and the vacating of sentences is costly, and budgets I believe most prosecutors wanted them to be. I've heard it from Dan Satterberg in King County, and I believe you as well. You need some help in the budget for your own budget, correct?
We do. The burden that it is placing on prosecutors' offices all over the state is significant. I mean, we're not just talking about vacating people's convictions for simple possession. We're talking about going back and resentencing people who may be currently in prison, whose prior criminal history may have included a simple possession charge. So they have to be what the term is, rescored and resentenced. And that is going to be a significant undertaking, both in prosecutors and courts and clerks and defense lawyers. And so it's massive, to say nothing of the fact that there are people that are going to be owed legal financial obligations, likely, who paid legal financial obligations under a simple possession conviction. And so there's that part of it as well. A rough estimate that I've heard is we're talking $100 million or more statewide just to address that aspect of it.
Just those repayment of fees and things like that.
Well, in the cost to the courts and the prosecutors and other criminal justice stakeholders. It is not insignificant, Hannah.
Definitely not. And we've seen, I know, just this week, as I'm sure you know, the Governor Inslee has commuted sentences as well for people that were in the state Department of Corrections custody and affected by this decision from the state Supreme Court. And you have vacated some sentences. Is there any help for these folks as they leave their wherever facility that they were in, to your knowledge, as far as helping them with treatment or reentry or anything like that? Because I know that's been an issue before.
Well, I can't speak for the action that the governor took. When we are obligated under the Blake decision to vacate these convictions that we have, we don't have the resources to provide folks the provision of treatment and services. So we certainly can't do that as a prosecutor's office. And I know that city and local government coffers are pretty thin right now. And so it's certainly the cities and counties are not able to bear that cost. But the folks who could step up could be our state legislature to step in and help to provide the provision of treatment and services for these folks. And there's not a lot of time left in the legislative session, but there still is some time to try to provide this, because there are a lot of people are just being left to their own devices. And so I think that's something that we absolutely need to focus on.
Definitely. It's like being set up to fail to be released like that. And I know there's 11 days, I believe, left in our legislative session. Let's spend our last a little over a minute talking about all of the activity here. That there's a lot of bills. Another one just came down yesterday from Roger Goodman and Tara Simmons. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it. It's less criminal justice, more racial equality, and more treatment. Have you had a chance to look at it at all?
I haven't. This is the first time I've heard of it. I can tell you that the bill that I'm most familiar with, and I'll keep it quick, is Senator Dinger's bill that has been part of the discussion here the last couple weeks. And I have I support Senator Dinger's bill. I'd like to review Senator Goodman or Representative Goodman and Simmons' bill to learn more about it. But what Senator Dinger's bill does is it replaces criminalization of simple use with the provision of treatment and services, and also provides a Blake reimbursement fund to give money to cities and local governments to help to fill that void. And so I'm impressed with Senator Dinger's bill, and we'll certainly keep an eye on the other legislation as it comes down.
Definitely. I expect a lot of activity in the next few days over both of those bills. Just quickly, what would be your message to our state lawmakers as we close out, Adam?
The legislature needs to step up. The state legislature created this problem. They created the statute. County prosecutors all over the state acted on behalf of the state in prosecuting these cases. The state needs to step up and address simple possession as the public health threat that it is, and I hope that they will do that.
All right, thank you. Snohomish County Prosecutor Adam Cornell.
You can ring the bell. Ring the bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. For me, this has felt like just one long vacation, but apparently many Americans haven't had enough vacation, and so they are getting ready to unlock all their stored-up vacation and just take a sabbatical. Rachel Bell, of course, is thinking exactly that. So what are your plans?
Well, the power of positive thinking that this last year has been a vacation led us all into your mind, Dave Ross. That's wonderful. This article is in The Atlantic, and it says, for one glorious summer, Americans will vacation like the French. So I think we all know by now that Americans are just absolute garbage at using their vacation time. We only get, 2 weeks on average anyway, and most people don't even take that. So Americans left 768 million vacation days on the table in 2018. But the speculation is that that's about to change this summer. We've all been cooped up for more than a year. A lot of people didn't use their vacation time last year. And so the idea is maybe everybody is going to be off this summer. Some offices are planning to close for a week this summer just to get it out there and let everybody take time off.
That makes sense. Why not just close down the whole country? Who says we have to stagger the vacations?
Yeah, that's what they do in Japan. When I lived there for a year, there are three holidays that are the biggest holidays, and everybody takes those weeks off. It is the worst idea ever because you have to try to fight with the rest of the country to make reservations to go to all of the vacation spots that everybody wants to go to. You have to plan it like 9 months in advance. But this is interesting. So the CEO of Booking.com put it this way. He said, the pent-up demand is a fire hose that's trying to burst through. That wasn't the interesting part. Reservations for Mexico through Priceline.com are up 230% from 2019. So people are really getting out there. But wait, this was the interesting part. The biggest spike on Priceline, which is a 165% bump over 2019, are these bundles of flight and hotels. Mm-hmm. And they speculate that the reason people want this flight and hotel combo is that workers want to find a good deal on an extended stay where they can vacation and work. So the fear is we haven't gone full European. The idea is that maybe the pandemic has actually made people more work obsessed because there's a much, you know, blurrier line between working and not working when you're working from home, and that people just can't even take a real vacation. They're going to go somewhere to a Hilton where they have good Wi-Fi and they'll still work while they're on vacation.
So a Wi-Fi vacation, huh?
Yeah. You don't do that, do you? When you're off, you're off, right?
Actually, it was, a year ago last March, I was actually on vacation. Then this COVID thing hit and they said, well, could you anchor the news? Here's this little unit you can take with you. And so that's
why. Oh, my God, that's right. I remember that now. Poor you.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's crying for me. But here's the good news. Apparently, the toilet paper shortage is over, which is good because I think this is actually, we're in April, right? Yeah, this is the 1 year anniversary of the great toilet paper shortage of 2020.
Oh my God. Yeah, they say for a 1 year, the best gift is toilet paper. Happy anniversary, Dave. Yeah, last year this time, America didn't have a square to spare.
No.
It kind of reminded me of, remember that 80s show Supermarket Sweep where people were running around the store throwing turkeys in their cart? That's what it was like with toilet paper. You know, people say they remember exactly where they were when Kennedy got shot. I remember the last time I bought toilet paper before it went completely extinct because, like, I remember every moment of that day. So they say that toilet paper sales are not back to normal now because people are buying less toilet paper than pre-pandemic. And that's not because we're going to the bathroom any less. People are still working from home and using more than they usually would. They think it's because people bought so much that they are now dipping into the reserves and won't have to buy any for who knows how long. So they interviewed a 62-year-old woman in New Rochelle, New York, named Marjorie Greenberg. Marjorie said, you never knew when you weren't going to be able to get it. So every time we went out to get some, we just kept buying it. And she says they've been storing it in every room of the house, the guest room, the back of the linen closet, the laundry room, in the basement. So yeah, last year, Americans spent more than $11 billion on toilet paper. That's up from $9 billion in a typical year. So $2 billion more on toilet paper last year.
Well, I believe it because I was at Costco a week ago and the entire back of the store was just stacked with toilet paper. I will say I've never seen such a wide variety of types and styles and softnesses of toilet paper in a Costco as I saw last week. So, yeah, it's now we got the reverse problem. What are we going to do?
I think we're going to have a black market where we're just buying toilet paper out of people's homes and not going to the store anymore. I remember so vividly, I was having dinner with my friend last year, and I said, I heard that people are buying a lot of toilet paper. He's like, oh, I heard that too. So we went across the street to the grocery store, and there was one pack left, and it was not my normal brand, and I really compromised and bought it, and I was so glad that I did because that was the last toilet paper I was able to find for months.
There you go. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Ring My Bell, brought to you by Chevrolet Buick GMC of Puyallup.